Manager.
I'm not playing myself down, but the players did the business. All these players were signing on the same day, and it lifted everybody. It lifted Sunderland, the city and the club. And we hadn't played a game yet. We weren't signing Ronaldo, but Ross and Stan were both Celtic players, good players. Dave, Graham, Liam, I knew them. You'd have looked at them and said, well, we're heading up the table. When you sign a player, you're sending a message to the fans and to the other clubs in your league. I rang Dwight York. It was 7 a.m. when I picked up the phone at the training ground, because he was in Australia with Sydney FC. He was their marquee player. So I rang him. All right, Yorkie. I got on well with Yorkie at United. He had the penthouse in Sydney Harbour and the Lamborghini, all the women. A hard life. But I knew he loved football. He loved the game and he liked the challenge. I said, do you fancy coming back to Sunderland? And he said, you want me to leave this? You want me to leave feckin' Australia? I said, yeah. And he said, yeah, I fancy it. I thought we'd get him on a free. He was 34, but we had to pay Sydney $250,000. The club wasn't happy, but Yorkie walked into our dressing room, like an actor, a character in the dressing room. He'd won the Champions League. He'd played for United. All right, lads, what's cooking? Yorkie was my best signing. Expectations around the city were high. We were hoping to get crowds of 40,000. Some of the players couldn't cope with it. But Yorkie was like, what's the problem? He brought an aura to the club that it hadn't had. It's all about characters. Yorkie arrived, and my staff were going, he's some man, isn't he? And I said, yeah, he's a top guy. And a good guy. I went to a lot of functions with Niall. He was trying to promote the club. We'd lost a lot of fans over the years, and he kept saying that we needed to get season ticket sales up. We were meeting and greeting fans, normally my worst fucking nightmare. But I enjoyed it. What I liked about Sunderland fans was that what happened on the pitch on a Saturday made or broke their week. That's not the case with every football club. So I thought, I think I love having that responsibility. We got off to a decent start, away to Derby. My first ever team talk was before that game. We were at the hotel. I picked my team, and I'd had to disappoint a few people. All right, lads, this is what Derby are like. We'd done a bit of homework in the previous 3 days. It had been a bit mad, trying to move to Sunderland, trying to get players in before the deadline. I decided the night before that I'd focus on the Derby goalkeeper. He was poor on crosses, but it went on a bit long. Dave Connolly, who I played with for Ireland, a funny old lad, strange lad, but he was a goal scorer, so he could be as tricky as he liked. He had his hand up at the back. I kept going. Lads, the first few balls, nail him. He's weak on crosses. He's good with his feet. I was keeping an eye on Dave. He still had his hand up. What is it, Dave? I was wondering, did he want to go out for a piss or something? He said, Gaffer, you know the keeper? I went, yeah. He was sold a week ago. Not injured. Fucking sold a week before. And I was supposed to be the big hero coming in to save the club. Fans and flags everywhere lifted onto their shoulders. That was my first team talk. So I went, hey lads, it just goes to show you, you can't get the fucking scout reports. I blamed the scout. And, actually, it helped. It relaxed everybody. It was good for me because it embarrassed me a bit, instead of trying to be the perfectionist, the sergeant major. It lightened the mood. Derby were doing well at the time. Billy Davis was managing them. They had good players. We were 1-0 down at half-time. If you'd seen the players when I walked into the dressing room, they were shitting themselves. They were expecting fireworks. Good managers have to keep people guessing. You can't be too predictable. Clough did it, and Ferguson. So I walked in. All right, lads. Relax. You're doing well. We're doing okay. Keep at it. Unless things were going really badly, I'd let the players settle down at half-time before I'd go into the dressing room. I give them a minute or two to gather their breath and to let me get my thoughts together. It was my first managerial job, so I wasn't going off on some tactical journey. My plan was to keep it simple. Brian Clough's advice to me on my debut for Forest, away to Liverpool, was, get it, pass it to one of your teammates, and move. Can you do that? And I went, yeah, of course I can do that. I've been doing it since I was a kid. Pass it and move. I'd made a career out of it. Part of my admiration for Brian Clough was the simplicity of the game he saw. Alex Ferguson's outlook was pretty simple too. I was looking at the players and they were expecting me to lose it because of my reputation. But I didn't want to be predictable. The explosion was in my locker. I think they knew that. In the media, after a press conference, whatever I said, I blasted. We could have done better, Keane blasts. Instead of not smiling, I glowered. It was a cartoon image of me, but now and again, I used that to my advantage. But that could also backfire on me, when I try to be genuine with people, or if I lost my rag just a little bit, it could become exaggerated. Raising my voice would be a big drama. Enthusiasm could be mistaken for anger. If people felt I was angry all the time, it would lose its effect. The picture would be out there that I was constantly at the players, even though I'd made the conscious decision to be calm on the sideline and, more often than not, relaxed in the dressing room. I hadn't had the players for pre-season, so I wasn't prejudging them. I was giving everybody the benefit of the doubt. The problem is, the longer you work with players, you end up looking at their defects. But at this stage, I was wondering if this was a defect in a particular player, or if he was just having a bad game. I was quite nice with them, polite and encouraging. I think it was clear to the players, whether it was my body language or tone of voice, or my analysis of Derby's ex-goalkeeper, that I was new to the job. They were well aware of that. I hadn't made any decisions yet. Four of them are gone next week, so they wanted to do well for me. It was all very innocent. That changes a bit when you start becoming familiar with people. You start picking holes. But my reputation as a player and my lack of managerial experience were both advantages at first. You're doing well. We're doing okay. Keep at it. We won 2-1. Chris Brown, a big lad, a typical championship striker, and Ross Wallace, one of the new lads, scored. I'd been used to winning as a player. This was a different kind of satisfaction. I could carry it into the training ground the following Monday. But I'd learn losing was different too. I carried much more responsibility. It was harder to recover. It took me far too long to get over a defeat. I was the same when I was a player, but this was worse. There has to be a certain amount of suffering, but not to the extent that I put myself through. I wouldn't eat properly. I felt I didn't deserve a good meal. That would have a knock-on effect, because I wouldn't sleep properly. When it came to handling defeats and victories, I had to balance wrong throughout my career. When we won, I'd go, brilliant, but we've got to win next week. When we lost, I'd never go, okay, we lost, but we still got next week. The key, I think now, is to move on quickly, if you can. If you're in sport, you're going to lose. We couldn't win every game. I'd never had an office before. No, I had a secretary. I had a phone. A phone with buttons and different lines. I had a leather chair that swung around, a swivel chair. For the first few days, I used to swing around on it. If any of the players or staff had peeped through the office window and seen me going, wee! The phone would ring, and I'd be pressing different buttons trying to get the right line. I didn't take proper advantage of the office, but I didn't really need to at first. The early sign-ins were all lads I knew. I didn't have to bring them in and sell the club to them. They were all eager to come. My initial reaction was, what do I do with this? Do I need an office? I was sitting in my chair going, what do I do? Your own office can be a lonely place. I'm not one for hanging up loads of pictures of my family. I had one of those electrical picture frames where the photos are repeated, but that was it. I remember thinking, I'm not going to get too comfortable here. But what I should have done was the opposite. I should have made myself comfortable, because you do end up spending a remarkable amount of time there. I should have made it a bit more homely with pictures of my family. When bears came to see me, they could have seen that other side of me. But even when things were going well, I thought, if things go badly, I want to be able to clear it out pretty quickly. One box. Keep it clean. Keep it tidy. And be ready for a quick getaway. I'm not sure now if that was the right way to be thinking. But it stopped me from getting too complacent. And ultimately, it wasn't my office. It was the club's. But, again, I think I was afraid to enjoy myself too much. The glass was always half empty. I'd be embarrassed to ask the secretary, Susan, to arrange anything for me. If I had to book a flight or something, I'd do it myself. She used to look after all the players. I'd give out to them sometimes, particularly when we lost. Keep away from my secretary. She works for me. But she must have been looking at me thinking, I'd be fucking unemployed soon. Tony had come to the club with me, and I brought in some of my own staff as I settled in over the next couple of months. I brought in Mike Clegg as our strength condition coach. Mike had been a player at United. Niall Bailey came in to coach the first team. He had coached the youth team at United. I brought in Antonio Gomez as my fitness coach, and Raymond van der Gouw as the goalkeeping coach. I played with Raymond at United. Mick Brown came in as chief scout. He'd been at United. Further down the line, I brought in Ricky Spragia, who had also known at United. With a good bunch, I felt very comfortable with my staff. I had to let some other people go. It was horrible. I still feel a bit guilty about it. But later, at Ipswich, I'd feel guilty about keeping some people on. Guilt comes with the job. Our next game was away to Leeds. It was brilliant. Won 3-0. Cav and Liam Miller scored, and another Irish lad, Stephen Elliott. I wasn't on a personal crusade against Leeds because of my past experiences as a player or because of the Alfie Halland episode. We just needed to win, and we played really well. A couple of Leeds fans tried to get at me in the dugout. People coming close to the dugout and shouting abuse is common enough, but these two tried to climb in. It didn't bother me. We'd won. The atmosphere in the dressing room afterwards was great. I was very happy with the players. These were lads who'd have a go. At the press conference after, I said that they'd shown character, desire and talent, and that I was very proud of them. I knew they'd hear the message. We all like to be praised, and they deserved it. Another away win, and the new lads were settling in. The fans were terrific too. We had a bit of momentum. We were up off the bottom of the table. That was the priority now. I was thinking like a manager. Leicester was next, at home. Suddenly, we were expected to win. We won at Derby, we won at Leeds, now we'll beat Leicester. But we didn't. We drew 1-1. Tobias Heisen scored for us when we were 1-0 down, which wasn't a bad thing. It was a reality check for us all. I could look at the group of players and go, no, we're still a bit short. What I found out quickly was, everything comes to the manager. He was constantly making decisions. Niall and the chief executive Peter Walker were brilliant. With experience, I realised that the job of those around you at the club is to help the manager. And Niall and Peter were a proper help to me. We were all on the same wavelength. I didn't come in going, I want us to be Real Madrid, but I did want to change things. The players' suits, the hotels we stayed in the night before matches, that's all money. They knew what I was trying to do, changing the mindset, and they were right behind me. When they didn't agree with me, they explained it well. Another reality check, a lesson in economics. Not that I wanted one. I was all about winning, at any cost. Economics was the last thing I wanted to hear about. A key to management, I think now, is to try and maintain that childlike love of the game. That innocence. Innocence, not naivety. Give people the benefit of the doubt. As the days go by, people start to challenge you. Not always deliberately. Kenny Cunningham kept calling me Rye. But I wasn't Rye anymore. I had to talk to him in my office. I felt uncomfortable about it. I'd played with Kenny, with Ireland. He was the Sunderland captain. I said, "Listen, Kenny, don't be calling me Rye anymore." I wasn't aware he was. I said, "You are. I'm the boss or the gaffer." "All right, Rye." That was it. Probably the longer you stay in management, these issues, being called Rye, become less important. But these small things, I had to nail them. It seems unimportant, but it actually is important. I had to make my mark. I couldn't have Kenny calling me Rye. It was just common sense. But a Dutch coach once said to me, "Common sense is not so common." I never felt 100% comfortable being called boss or gaffer. But I insisted on it because, from the start, they all called me that. And I couldn't have two or three not doing it. I had to be consistent. If I go back into management, it's a tweak I'd make, I think. I wouldn't have them call me gaffer. It doesn't happen in other industries. And I would certainly have felt more comfortable being called by my name. I had people of 50 or 60 who'd been working at the club for years calling me boss. I think I felt I hadn't earned the right to be called boss. But even Tony was calling me boss. I felt like saying, "Don't call me boss, just call me Rye." It's the tradition in football, but I like to go against tradition now and again. If I'm comfortable, I'm better at my job. It's more human. It was hard to get used to the number of staff employed by the club. The sheer numbers. The academy, the canteen, all these people. Trying to get to know people's names. It's trivial but vital. I found that hard. And I think most managers would tell you the same. Myself and Tony were being pulled left, right and centre, and we had more games coming right up. "Gaffer, do you want to travel at 2 or 3 o'clock next Friday?" And I was going, "Ah, Jesus, let me look at that next week, a bit closer to the day." You're being introduced to one of the club staff, but your head is spinning a bit because your priority is getting a result on Saturday. "My name is Paul." I think of Paul McGrath, someone I knew to help me remember the name. I think of the staff member as Paul McGrath. I was learning the importance of remembering and using people's names. There were little things I did in the early months that I knew were appreciated. Sunderland is a cold place in winter, nearly all year. It would be freezing. There was a hut down at the bottom of the training ground, and I'd see the groundsman going in there. I was chatting to them one day, and they told me that they had their lunch in the hut. I said, "But we've got a canteen. Come and have your lunch with us." That was me just being polite. But it had an impact. Another little lift. They started coming in every day. I'd go, "Grab your food, lads." I wasn't being a hero. It might have had something to do with where I come from. I couldn't sit and eat my pasta looking out the window at the lads having their sandwiches and freezing to death. I love pork and onion sandwiches myself, but not in the field in the middle of winter. And the groundsmen have the hardest job at a football club. The games were coming thick and fast. In management, you're supposed to have short-term aims and long-term aims. Our aim, mine and Tony's, was to get through the bloody day. There was one day, two lads came to give myself and Tony a talk about Prozone, the performance analysis package. The club didn't have it, so these two lads wanted to sell us the product. We were in the players' lounge. There was a big screen in there and comfortable chairs, and both of us fell asleep. The lights were out, to be fair. Afterwards, I asked Tony, "Did you fall asleep?" And he said, yeah, did you? We were embarrassed about it, but not sure if the two lads from Prozone knew we'd had our little power nap. We bought it anyway. We watched DVDs of the opposition in that room. Leather chairs, the heat. Years later, after I'd left, I was talking to Seamus McDonough, who'd worked with Martin O'Neill at Sunderland, as Martin's goalkeeping coach. Seamus said, "You know that room where you watch all the matches?" And I went, "Yeah." And he said, "You couldn't keep your fucking eyes open, could you?" "Yeah, we were the same." It was a relief hearing Seamus, because myself and Tony thought we were being unprofessional. Mind you, Seamus is well over 70, so he's entitled to fall asleep. Having pros on at a club can be very useful, although it's expensive to set up, possibly over 100 grand a year. Cameras have to be placed throughout the stadium. They monitor distances covered by each player, crosses into the box, fitness levels, a whole range of statistical information. I was open to all that, but I wouldn't be dictated by it. It was useful if a player questioned what you were saying about his game or his stats. If we didn't think he was run enough, and he disagreed, we could go, "Well, we've got backup here." Some players almost lived off the stats. They might say, "Well, I ran 15 miles. And I'd say, "Yeah, that's because you kept giving the fucking ball away." The stats would give you useful feedback, but it was just a tool. Immediately after a game, the statistician might come up and say, "We didn't get enough crosses in." But I'd have seen that already. I was at the game. Some players love getting the information and watching the DVDs. We found that the defenders, in particular, were keen on looking back over clips of games. "Can I see where I was when that cross came in?" Defenders think more about the game than attacking players. The forwards tend to be more instinctive. When I was a player, I'd be home at 1 or 2 o'clock. If it was 2, because I'd stayed behind to do some extra stretches, I'd think to myself, "I had a long day today." The length and rhythm of my working day had changed completely. Engaging with so many people was all new. Decisions coming at me, it took a while to get used to it. There was one day, a lad called Bill, a big Sunderland fan, the tattoos and everything, a really nice fella. He was the masseur. He came in to me. "Gaffer, we're travelling next week. What soup do you want for the bus?" I went to myself, "Fucking soup? I had so many things to do." When I was a player, I was almost wrapped in cotton wool. Now I was in the real world, and it was a shock. I was signing players for millions of pounds, releasing young players, letting staff go, people's livelihoods, knowing they had mortgages. I was bringing adults into my office and saying, "I don't like the way you're behaving." I was making changes, timetable changes. "We always train at 10:30. Well, now we're training at 10. I'd feel conflict sometimes from people. A bit of paranoia. Who likes me? Who doesn't like me? The groundsmen like me because I let them into the canteen, but I couldn't please everybody. The soup almost put me over the edge. I think I said, "Fuck you and the soup," in a nice way. He took a well. We laughed about it. I think he realised that his timing hadn't been good. And it took me a while to understand that the soup was important. Important to Bill, and important to the club, and me. The next game, we lost. 3-1 at Ipswich. It was an important day for me. I was always looking to see what the staff contributed on match day. It's a day out for some. Others like to go out and get pissed the night before. It's a tradition in football. I didn't want it. I wanted my staff in bed at a decent time. I was keeping an eye on all that. That day at Ipswich, one staff member took charge of the music in the dressing room. It might seem strange, but you find out about characters when you look to see who's in charge of the music. A young lad might want to put on the latest sound. An older player might say, "I'm the senior player," and put himself in charge of it. But I noticed none of the players were taking charge of the music, and this was a concern for me. A member of staff was in charge of it. I was looking at him thinking, "I hope someone nails him here." If I'd been a player and one of the staff was taking control of the music, I'd have been going, "Hey, it's the player's dressing room. The staff have to know their place." The last song that was played before the players went out onto the pitch was "Dancing Queen" by ABBA. What really worried me was that none of the players, nobody said, get that shit off. I stood back and thought, it's not my place either. I'm learning. We went 1-0 up, but we lost 3-1. I don't think it was down to Dancing Queen, but after the match, they criticised the players. It was one of the few times that I lost the rag. They had to take responsibility, I told them. It was their music. What motivates you? This is your music. They're going out to play a match. Men versus men. Testosterone levels were high. You've got to hit people at pace. Fucking Dancing Queen. I wouldn't have minded if it had been one of ABBA's faster ones. It worried me. I didn't have as many leaders as I thought I had. But even so, I remember saying at the time that I wouldn't want to be working anywhere else but Sunderland. And I meant it. I had a strong feeling for the players and the club. I already felt it was my club. The ABBA fan moved on not long afterwards. 7. As we went in, Steve was going, all right, lads, all right. Then he put his head on his desk and went, you fucking lucky bastards. You fucking lucky bastards robbed us. Nobody can really prepare you for management. I'd done my UEFA B badge and was well into my UEFA A. These are stepping stones. In any other industry, I'm sure the stones are of help. But in this industry, football, they're almost no good to you at all. I feel a bit sad saying that, because the courses were good. But when you get into the actual job and you've got players in your office and they're demanding to leave, or one lad's been drinking and another one's got gambling problems, or staff are coming to you because they've got marriage difficulties, you're going, fucking hell, they didn't teach me this. I hadn't anticipated that I'd be dealing with personal problems. I thought my management of the players would be quite straightforward. But saying, just get on with it, isn't enough when there's a man in your office who's getting divorced or whose wife has just had a miscarriage. Take 3 days off, don't worry about it. One morning we were training and the police, two police officers, came out onto the training pitch. We're here to arrest one of your players. It was Carlos Edwards, and they were taking him in because he hadn't paid a load of driving or parking fines. He was a really good lad. I went, can you wait till we're finished training? After training, we persuaded the police not to arrest Carlos, that we'd do whatever was necessary to get the fines paid and everything sorted out. They said, okay, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. As you gain a bit of experience, you end up coping. There were some things, players' problems, that I think I dealt with quite well. I felt comfortable enough talking about the drinking or gambling, although I'd never been a gambler, and I tried to give logical, practical advice. But when it came to personal or family problems, I felt a bit out of my depth and I didn't want to pretend that I had anything to offer other than the time off to try and sort themselves out. People love giving the information when you're a manager, whether you want it or not. Good stuff, bad stuff, players up to no good. Two players were out drinking till 4 a.m. I called them in and I tried to treat them the way I'd like to have been treated. A lot of it is common sense, but it's tiring. Playing had been so much easier. I lost my temper 3 times over the season, but never on the sideline. The first time was after the Ipswich game. We'd been 1-0 up. Our keeper was poor. Dancing Queen. That was enough. Sometimes losing my rag just involved me kicking over the tactics board. It became one of my favourites. The kit man, Cookie, enjoyed that one too. If I came in angry at half-time, I'd say to him, Cookie, get the tactics board up. He'd set it up, and I'd kick it over. Give it a karate kick. It would let off a bit of steam, and by kicking the board, I was telling the players that this particular game wasn't about tactics. Sometimes you need the board. But my point now was, this has nothing to do with fucking tactics. This is about how much you want it. And they seem to want it more than you. The Championship is a lot less tactical than the Premiership. It's more about the characters in your dressing room. Into October, when we lost two more games, Preston beat us 4-1 away. Preston was doing well. Paul Simpson was managing them and they had David Nugent, who I tried to sign the following season. But it was a bad defeat. And our goal, Stan Varga scored it, came when we were already 4-0 down. Then Stoke beat us 2-1. Rory Delap broke his leg playing for Stoke, only a few weeks after I'd let him go there on loan. I rang him in hospital. I'd had to let some players go out on loan. Rory went to Stoke, and John Stead went to Derby. It was all about trying to balance the books. I brought in Dave Connolly, and the club was paying him good money, so I had to let Steady, another striker, go. If I let a player go, I always thought it was for his benefit. Steady went to Sheffield United later in the season. They were in the Premiership. If the player wasn't getting a game, I wouldn't hold on to him. There was a financial benefit for the club too, get them off the wage bill, and there might be a loan fee. That was the business side of it. And I discovered a lot more about that later, when I tried to get some players in on loan. The defeats, 3 and 4 games, worried me a bit. When a new manager comes in, there's often a feel-good factor, a honeymoon period, new ideas, and a few new players. That phase seemed to be over. But I'll always remember the Sunderland fans at Stoke after the game. The away fans' enclosure is near the tunnel, and they gave me a great send-off, even though we'd just been beaten. The Sunderland fans travelled in big numbers, and they were noisy. They were as passionate as the United and Celtic fans. I applauded them. Sometimes the applause is an apology, and I mentioned them regularly at the press conferences throughout the season. We got 2 good results in a row, at home to Barnsley, then at Hull. Ross Wallace scored in the last minute of the Hull game, then got sent off. A second yellow for taking off his jersey. Removing your jersey is an automatic yellow, but a lot of footballers shouldn't do it anyway, and Ross would have been one of them. He was always going to struggle keeping his body fat down below 10%. "Here, listen," I joked. "We don't mind some lads taking their tops off, but not you, you little fat fucker. You'll get my fitness coach sacked." I didn't crucify Ross for the offence. He'd scored the winner. It was an emotional moment. At the press conference after the game, journalists kept asking what disciplinary measures I'd be taking against him. I said that I'd have a look at it during the week, but I didn't find him at all. We were winning a few matches. We were growing in confidence, and I was growing in confidence. I was thinking, yeah, this is for me, management. When you're winning, you don't see yourself losing. We'd moved up the table, to 13th. But we were struggling to be consistent. Everyone remembers Sunderland going from the bottom to the top in a couple of months, but it didn't happen that way. It was hard work. We were beaten at home by Cardiff 2-1. Cardiff were a good team, but just when I thought we were making progress, we came up short. Again. You lose a match, you start doubting your players. Then we were beaten at Norwich. That was followed by a draw with Southampton. We were 1-0 up, but Gareth Bale scored for them in injury time. Bale played at left back. He was outstanding. The best player on the pitch. Everything he did had a bit of quality about it. He was 17. Even though they'd scored in injury time, I couldn't begrudge Southampton the result. I was grateful for the draw. We won at home to Colchester. Our results so far, it was proper hit and miss. In the meantime, my wife was coming up from Manchester with the kids, and we were trying to find a school. A Catholic school was important to us because the kids were already at one. The schools were good, and we liked their message. We were looking at houses, but we couldn't find a school. Weeks went by, then months, and my family hadn't moved. But I was happy enough with the arrangement. It suited me. the balance between my personal and professional lives. So I said, it's working. In the end, the family stayed in Manchester. The travel wasn't killing me. I liked driving. I liked driving late at night or early in the morning. It was a 2.5 hour drive. A nice drive, past Leeds. I'd have 2 or 3 days at home. I'd work hard at Sunderland, and then I'd go home to people who didn't really care too much about my professional life. Funnily enough, they were more interested in my job as a manager. I think they understood that I had more responsibility, and they appreciated the pressure I was under. They were rooting for me more. Before games, they'd go, good luck, Dad. Whereas, when I was a player, I'd go, I'm off. Daddy's going to Old Trafford to work. And they'd hardly notice. I rented a flat in Durham, in a student area. I could go into the cafes because, generally speaking, students aren't that interested in football, so they hadn't a clue who I was. I'd be in bed at 8 or 9 anyway. I should have decorated the flat a bit more. Made it more of a home. I wish I'd made more of an effort. I could have got a good telly, a nice sofa, but I ended up living like a student myself. Pot noodles and tins of beans. After a month or two, I was worried about the body fat levels of some of the players. Particularly some of the lads who hadn't been playing regularly. I don't mean that they were half a stone overweight. I put an announcement up on the notice board. Unless players could get their body fat down to under 10%, they wouldn't be selected to play. They excluded the goalkeepers, because they need to carry an extra bit of fat to cushion their landings. They were pleased with that. Every now and again, you have to change the routine. The notice board was down near the players' dressing room. I kept my distance as a manager. I didn't go into the dressing room too often. It was the players' area. But I knew that when a notice went up on the board, squads or trips, it became a hub of activity. The body fat announcement was just a small idea, something to get them talking. It was fun and games, really. A little threat. I was putting pressure on the players, and it worked. I'd been pals with everybody. I played in teams with a lot of them. I just wavered on the niceness a bit. But if a player stayed just over the limit, and he was important to us, I wasn't going to drop him for it. Mick McCarthy was managing Wolves, and he rang me about a player. I think it was Neil Collins, who he wanted to take on loan. He rang me direct, straight through to my office. All right, Roy. We chatted about the player, and about this and that. It wasn't an awkward conversation, and I was glad he'd rung me. It had crossed my mind that we'd be meeting during the course of the season. Our teams would be playing against each other. And I was a member of the LMA now too, the League Managers Association. There'd be functions I'd have to go to. We were bound to meet. I think it was Mick who suggested that we meet up for a chat. We both thought it was a good idea. We met at the Four Seasons Hotel near Manchester Airport, and it was a bit like the meeting with Niall. A nice anti-climax. I said I was sorry about what happened in Saipan. I'm not sure I had anything to apologise for, but you try to move on. But that was that. It was important, and I'm glad it happened. We were playing Wolves away in November on a Friday night. The media was all over it, and the game was live on Sky. The build-up to the game was all, are they going to shake hands? But we'd already met, and we'd kept that to ourselves. So it was no big drama for us. We shook hands before the game, but it wasn't pre-arranged. We just shook hands. Managers do it before every game. It's standard practice. The only difference this time was that there were 50 cameramen around us. But that was another night I lost my rag. We were 1-0 down at half-time. We were shocking. I told Cookie to get the tactics board out, and I did a bit of a Bruce Lee on it. I think the players were distracted by the whole Keane-McCarthy stuff. And I have to ask myself the question, was I extra angry because I didn't want to lose to Mick McCarthy's team? I'd hope not. But we were on TV and we were shit. Poor Cookie had to spend ages looking for all the little players off the tactics board. We drew 1-1, but we were lucky. Our keeper, Darren Ward, kept us in the game. And our goal, shot by Stevie Elliott, was deflected. We beat QPR 2-1 away, then Norwich, the return fixture at home. We beat them 1-0. Darren Murphy scored in both games. Our next game, the following Saturday, was at home to Luton. I was called to a meeting at the club on Friday night. Niall and the club secretary were there. Three of the players, Chris Brown, Liam Lawrence and Ben Alnwick, had allegedly been caught on video making out with a girl. The club hierarchy was panicking about it because the story was going up here in the Sun. The two lads who were important to me were Brown and Lawrence, because we had a game the next day and they were both on my team. They hadn't done anything illegal, so I said I was going to play them. But Niall said that the club was insistent that they wouldn't play. I didn't play them. It was the first time, I suppose, that I was challenged as a manager. I wasn't kicking and screaming, but I was upset about it. But I could see the club's point of view. We were trying to build a new Sunderland, a new image, new standards, and the club wasn't telling me that the players could never play for Sunderland again. I told Lawrence and Brown that they were out for Saturday's match, but letting them know that they'd be back in the team at some stage. I made it clear to them that it wasn't my decision. I thought it was important that they could think, well, the manager's still all right with us. We won without them. We beat Luton 2-1. Murph and Dave Connolly scored. The whole thing had annoyed me, but I think I'd have been more annoyed if they'd been late for training. I'd been a player myself, and I'd been in trouble. I'd caused the club and the manager grief. So I always try to be fair with the players. When I called them into the office, say, for drinking, I'd let them know that it wasn't on. But I'd like to think that I was understanding. I wasn't condoning their behaviour. But I was their manager, not their father or judge and jury. And I'd have a football match coming up that I had to try and win. That, ultimately, was my job. I needed the players. Lawrence and Brown weren't Messi and Ronaldo, but they were important to me. Later in the season, I had fallen out with Liam Lawrence on the training pitch. I had the lads playing 11v11, and we too many there, more than 22. Some players weren't getting the full game, and Liam was one of them. He wasn't happy about it, and stormed into the dressing room. He said he wasn't going to stand on the sideline. I said, "See you in my office." The two of us were shouting at each other in the office. I think now that it would have been wise to have someone else present. If I thought there was going to be a confrontation or a contract issue or a player wanting to leave, someone to witness the conversation, all the he said this and I said that. I told Liam, it's no big deal. Other players had to stand on the sideline to give another player a run out. That was all there was to it. As simple as that. But Liam was going, I'm not putting up with all this. It was a proper shouting match. It was more than that. It was intense. I think I might have grabbed him. There might have been a bit of grappling when he started to leave the office. We were alone, but everyone in the other offices would have heard us. But it was good. Everything had been going well. I'd had the full support of everyone. This was my first real confrontation. I loved it. I thought to myself, I want more of this. One of these a day. I don't really mean that, but it was good to let off some steam. It didn't exactly shock me, but I was surprised that Liam was so angry and that I was so angry. Up to now, whatever I'd said, people had done. This was the first time a lad had defied me, and in front of the other players. So I'd had to think fast. How am I going to deal with this? Liam just lost his rag on the day. There was no bad blood between us. And I kind of admired him for standing up for himself. But, ironically, or maybe not so ironically, we got a call from Stoke the next morning. They wanted to know if Liam was available. I said, yeah, but not because of the bust-up. As I've said, when you bring players in, you have to let other lads go. Liam came in just after the call and apologised. I'm sorry about yesterday. I said, no problem, but I'm just after getting a call from Stoke. Do you fancy it? He said, all right. It suited everyone. Our next game, a 2-2 draw away to Burnley, was a big turning point for us. We were 2-0 down and we were awful. Grant Leadbitter got one back for us, but then we equalised in injury time, Dave Connolly again. We came away with a point, but we could have been beaten 5 or 6 nil. Steve Cotterill was managing Burnley at the time. After a game, the tradition is you have a drink with the opposition manager, whether you won, lost or drew. Everybody puts on a front. Well played. Who have you got next week? I thought you played well. I'd speak to the manager. The goalkeeping coach would speak to the goalkeeping coach. This time, we were a bit embarrassed going in. We got a point in the last kick of the game and we hadn't deserved it. We felt like we'd mugged them. As we went in, Steve was going, "All right, lads, all right." Then he put his head on the desk and went, "You fucking lucky bastards. You fucking lucky bastards robbed us." It was brilliant. He was being himself. Honest. He wasn't going, "Well done, lads, good game. Here's a Diet Coke, right? Well played." We all do it. We go, "The fucking bastards." But only after the other team have got on their bus and gone home. But Steve did it in front of us. We all relaxed. We were laughing. Usually when you go into another manager's office, nobody's relaxed. Everyone's acting. You can't be yourself. If you've won the game, you're buzzing. If you've lost, you're pissed off. But you can't express these feelings in front of the other team's manager and staff. A year later, Blackburn came up to the stadium alight. Mark Hughes, who I'd played with at United, was managing Blackburn, and they beat us 2-1. They robbed us. Everyone was listening to the conversation between myself and Mark in my office after the game. He asked me where I lived. Durham. How long did it take you to get from Manchester to Durham? About 2.5 hours. How many miles is it, door to door? I'm not knocking him. We've got time for Sparky. We couldn't be ourselves. I answered him, 138, I think it was. When he left, my staff were going, "What the fuck was that about?" But it was just awkward. And it was like that every week. "Who have you got next week? Where did you stay last night?" But this, Steve losing his rag, was one of the highlights of the season. We'd shown another side of our team, the fighting side. We kept giving ourselves mountains to climb, but the players were climbing them. We were fighting and scrapping. We got a draw we hadn't deserved. We'd scored an injury time in front of our fans. We showed a clip of the celebrations to the players because it had been on the news, on television. Dave Connolly had jumped into the away stand to celebrate with the Sunderland fans. One or two of the fans fell out of the stand. It was only a small drop, but still they went head over heels onto the pitch. But it was creating a story that we were all in this together, the players, the fans, the club. We're Sunderland, and we never give up. We stay to the end. As the season went on, we got a lot of late goals, because the teams we were playing believed we'd get a late goal. It wasn't about us believing. It was about them. Dropping back and dropping back. But it still hadn't crossed my mind that we might get promoted. I just thought, it's been difficult, but we're moving away from relegation. After the Burnley game, I said that we weren't ready for the playoffs yet, and that some of the players weren't up to that challenge. I'd say something like that occasionally to test the players' mentality, or as a message to Niall and the board, to bring them and me back down to reality. If the board were getting a bit giddy, and thinking that we had all the players we needed, I was reminding them that we needed a few more. The January transfer window was coming up. I wasn't playing games with the board. We did need the players if we were going to go further. And if we had a midweek game, there'd be 4 press conferences in the week. I had to say something to the media. There'd be a press conference on Friday, then again immediately after the match on Saturday. If we played on a Tuesday night, I had to talk to the media on Monday and after the match. It was boring. The same questions 4 times a week. The Championship was full of big historical games. Leeds, Derby, Leicester, Wolves, Sunderland. But I didn't like that term, the sleeping giant. That was why I thought that me going into Sunderland cold was a good thing. I didn't care about the history at first. The reality was, This is where we are, near the bottom of the championship. Let's get the house in order. As I got a feel for the club, I began to appreciate the importance of history. I met some of the ex-players, including Charlie Hurley, who was a massive star in Sunderland, and Dennis Stewart, who'd been in the team that won the FA Cup in 1973. I started to get pictures up on the walls, in the dressing room and in the training ground. The training ground had the feel of a private hospital. Brilliant facilities, but cold. The walls were bare. Let's get some pictures up. Bob Stokoe and the 1973 FA Cup, previous teams that had won promotion, and pictures of the fans. I spoke to the staff about the need to dress well for match days. I was putting my marker down. Bill de Masseur had a Sunderland tattoo down the side of his leg. I remember talking to him in my office. I said, I know on match days you wear short socks. Can you wear bigger socks? I have nothing against tattoos, but I'm trying to send a message. Wear Sunderland now. It was a strange one. I kept reminding myself that I was speaking to a grown man. But he said, yeah, I know where you're coming from. Brilliant gaffer. You're dead right. Bill was a really good guy, a big Sunderland fan. He wasn't going, who do you think you are? I'm proud of my tattoos. It was a chat that could have gone wrong. He took it in very good spirit. And I think that summed up my time at the club. If I'd said to people, jump, they would have said, how high? We were beaten by Crystal Palace away. And then we beat Leeds 2-0 at home on St Stephen's Day, Boxing Day. Dave Connolly and Grant Leadbitter scored. There were over 40,000 in the ground. The atmosphere was brilliant. Leeds brought a load of fans up with them too, and there's a lot of hatred between Leeds and Sunderland going back to 1973 FA Cup final. Dennis Wise was managing Leeds, and Gus Poyet was his assistant. We were attacking. And Gus got a ball from one of the ball boys. He kicked it out onto the pitch and stopped the game. He was sent to the stand. There was proper rivalry between the two teams, so it was a good win for us. Yorkie was starting to look sharper, considering he could have been on Bondi Beach having his Christmas dinner. We lost at home to Preston 1-0. I'd sent 10 players out on loan, and I was regretting it now. I particularly regretted letting them play against us. The lad Tommy Miller played against us for Preston, and he played very well. I shouldn't have let him play. It was a big mistake. The only loser was going to be me. If the player didn't play well, it was almost irrelevant. But if he had a good game, it was going to be, why are you letting him play against us? Or, why is such a good player out on loan in the first place? Because there was a guarantee that he'd have something to prove when he was out on the pitch. In my innocence, I didn't want to begrudge the lad a game. I was still learning not to think like a player, and to be a bit more ruthless. At the end of 2006, we were 12th in the league. We had 37 points from 26 games, and we were 10 points behind Preston, who were second in the table. Generally, if you can average 2 points a game, you'll be promoted. We were well behind that. Our first game of the new year was on 2nd of January, away to Leicester. Leicester were good, but we won 2-0. Dave Connolly scored again. He was doing the business for us and really proving his worth. That was the day we took off. The day our surge to the top started. Although we didn't know it then. But I began to wonder if we could kick on and get into one of the playoff positions. A top two place, and automatic promotion, seemed too far off. I didn't think it would happen that year, it was too early. But the playoffs would be progress. But we had, as the biggest word in football, momentum. It's like a tidal wave. Southampton away. We scored in the last minute. Burnley at home. Down 3-2, we scored with the last kick of the game. Derby at home, it's 1-1. Liam Miller scores the winner in injury time with a header. And he's the smallest man on the pitch. Momentum. We had it. We brought in some players in January. Carlos Edwards from Luton. Anthony Stokes from Arsenal, and Johnny Evans. We got Johnny on loan from Manchester United. They were all good signings, brilliant, and just what we needed. One of the reasons they worked, I think, is because I knew a bit about them, beyond the stats, something about their personalities. Carlos had played against us when we beat Luton earlier in the season, and I'd seen what a good player he was. He gave us a right-sided midfielder. He had pace, and he could get us up the pitch. We could counter-attack away from home. Johnny was a centre-half. He had the qualities of a Manchester United player, and he was bringing them to Sunderland. For such a young man, who was 19, who was very mature and a born leader. Johnny was unbelievable for us. He lived with his mam and dad in Sale, near my home, so I picked him up there and brought him to see the setup at Sunderland. I knew I was on a winner. I knew him, but I knew what he was about. I remembered an incident when I was still at United. There'd been a fight in the canteen and Johnny had looked after himself well. I think he knocked the other lad out. I knew Johnny was tough. Stokesy got his vital goals towards the end of the season. He was a good signing for us. Because there'd been a lot of competition for him, Celtic and Charlton, who were still in the Premiership then, were after him. So signing Stokesy sent out another message. We could compete with other clubs. I spoke to Stokesy's dad and, for some reason, he thought I'd be able to keep his son on the straight and narrow, because Stokesy was a bit of a buy. I can't think of a player who was brought in that season who was disappointed. They all contributed. We brought in good players to add to the good players we already had. Regardless of where we finished the season, these players would do a job for us for a good few years. We were knocked out of the FA Cup in the third round by Preston. That was a disappointment, because I'm a fan of the FA Cup. A run in the Cup would have been great. I would never have worried about a fixture pile-up. The financial incentives were there too. A Cup run brings money to the club. But we played Preston three times over the season, and they definitely had an edge over us. We beat Ipswich 1-0, Dave Connolly again. Then we beat Sheffield Wednesday away, 4-2. Yorkie scored a great goal, a nice little dink over the keeper. But we were 3-0 up, and they came back to 3-2. I nearly had a fucking heart attack. That was the third time I lost my rag. Again, there was a message. Everyone in the dressing room was delighted. We'd won 4-2. But we should never have let them come back. I told them that it wasn't good enough, and that there had to be consistent standards. They couldn't let the other team back into the game. They might get away with it against Wednesday, but not against better teams. It's not a bad idea to be critical of the players after they've won a match. They took the criticism, but they'd still won. And it's not as if I'd lost my temper because we'd lost. That wasn't the excuse. So they couldn't dismiss it. But the atmosphere among our fans at that game was fantastic. They started singing a version of Hey Jude. Na, 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 Kino, at half-time, and kept at it right through the second half. It carried on for the rest of the season. I took it with a pinch of salt. Although I'd never heard supporters singing about a manager like that before. I should probably have appreciated it more. But I didn't want to enjoy it too much, because it can all change so quickly. We were doing well, but I knew that we'd eventually have a dip in form. Real Madrid and Manchester United have had dips. At Sunderland, we were going to have a big fucking dip. And when that happens, who's the first to get it? The manager. I wasn't the messiah, and I didn't want to be seen as one. Anyway, I've never been a big lover of that song. It might have been different if it had been a song I liked. I brought in Stern John before the transfer deadline from Coventry City. He was one of my best signings ever. I was at home on a Monday night watching Coventry away to Plymouth. It was pissing down, and it looked like a shocking game. But every time the ball went to Stern John, it stuck. It stuck with him. He couldn't run, but we just needed someone who could get hold of the ball. Dave Connolly and Daryl Murphy were about getting into the box and scoring, but there's a saying in football, when it goes up to him, It sticks. When the ball went up to stern, it stuck. Brian Clough used to say to his son Nigel, fucking stick.